Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
You know, Carl, do you have a workshop?
Yes.
Okay. And have you ever built something?
I had to think twice because I lived in Tucson for years and there are no basements in Tucson.
That's right.
And so, but I did have I had to build an outside workshop. Now I have one in the basement in Michigan.
Okay. So it's probably much cooler in the summer in the basement.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
It is.
So when we build stuff, right, when we make a product or we make, even at home, we make a bookshelf, for example, and so on, there's all kinds of sources of variability, notwithstanding your excellent craft skills and building stuff together. But I'm sitting in my area, in a little office area where I'm set up for recording, and I'm looking at a bookshelf that my wife and I made in a little alcove that was originally a desk and a light, and we took the desk out and we put in shelves. And a very, very simple process, right? We had to cut, basically we bought 12-inch wide boards and we cut them to length and fit them in there. The trouble was, it took much, much longer than we thought it would, because obviously we weren't professional craftsmen and all this other stuff that knew what we were doing. But the boards weren't always cut exactly to the length we thought they were cut at. And the wall, the wall that they're fitting between the part sides of the alcove were not parallel, which we found out the hard way. Right. Right. But it goes back to, and I'm sure I've mentioned this to you before, is that when I first started in industry, I started as a manufacturing engineer, right? And so I very, very quickly learned that it's always the designer's fault. There's nothing we can do.
It's the other way around, Fred.
No.
It's always the manufacturing engineer's fault.
No way. And I made the argument that if you made a good design, a robust design, I could put all the components in a paper bag, shake it up, and you would get a perfect product.
If you would just build it the way we told you to build it, it would work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That in where's where the rub is, I think,
yes.
Is that we use this concept of design for manufacturing is one of the many design for X pieces of it. Now, over my career, in building on my manufacturing background, I often found that the manufacturing people were very interested in improving yield, right? They wanted less scrap and more products going out the door for batch of raw material. And I thought, well, that's, you know, I can see where the money is on that. That makes sense. But it often paled into the impact of either opening up the specs so we improved yield or the process, the cost of reducing variability, right, was another tool we used to understand variability and reduce it so that we improve the yield. But there's a pretty cool correlation between if you can make it exactly as it was designed, to your point, not only did we get better yield, right, it actually worked better in the field. And that's where the real money is that the reliability part just works. Right. Customers are happy. We don't have call center problems. We don't have field returns. We don't have escalations. All of those benefits come from making a product well. And so it's assumes it's a good design, all those kind of things. But I found that manufacturing could not make a product better than its design. Right.
Yes, indeed.
Right. But we certainly could make it worse.
Yeah, well, there's a set of tools that are part of manufacturing engineering, the reliability of manufacturing engineering. Like in our last podcast, we talked about tools and what the selection criteria is, and we focused mostly on design for reliability. But there's also this reliable manufacturing side, and there's a unique set of tools to improve the reliability of the manufacturing process. So,
There's two pieces here. There's one is
yes.
How consistent can I create the product, right? See, I always think of it as what's the output is I want a good manufacturing process that's consistent so that I get a good, reliable product for the customer. But the operations manager wants a consistent process so that they reduce the yield loss, for example, which are both, I think, they're related to each other. One helps the other.
Well, let's just do something like we did in the previous podcast. I'd like to brainstorm maybe three or four of the manufacturing reliability tools and then see when do you use them versus when do you not use them.
Okay. Process control.
Process control.
SVCs in that mix.
Statistical process control would be an example of.
Yeah.
But there's process control plans that are one of the outcomes of process FMEA. Mm-hmm. So let's we could take statistical process control,
okay,
which is a
well-known you wanted to tool. Do PFMEA, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I wasn't actually steering.
Okay,
but then there's the subject of let's call it reliability-centered maintenance.
Oh yeah, good one.
Okay,
yeah.
So there's one, and how about your turn?
Let's see. Measurement systems, measurement system analysis.
Okay, MSA. And then one more, if we have time, would be environmental stress screening.
ESS. Okay. Yeah. And that's, again, like last time, I think ESS, each of these is really a subset or an example of a much larger group of tools.
Exactly. So they fit into a cascading or hierarchical high-level category to more discrete. Mm-hmm. As we talked about, FMEA on the design side was part of the risk reduction bucket, but then there's FMEA, but then there's types of FMEAs where you have design and process and software. And so the same thing applies on the manufacturing side. So what are the triggers for statistical process control? Do you use it all the time? I'm being devil's advocate as you can tell. Okay. Or do you use it all the time or do you use it under certain circumstances?
I think because I've had so much success with doing control charts, for example, just plot the data, that I recommend it very, very often. So it's hard for me to say I don't use it all the time because I'm trying to think of examples where I don't. But the triggering questions are, is my process consistent? Is it predictable? If I'm going to make more than one, right, and it's not an iterative make one craftsman style, but I'm going to make 10 of these in the month, or I'm going to make 10 an hour or 10 per minute. I got machines and people in a process that my underlying assumptions in designing that is the one I make this morning is going to be very, very similar to the one I make next week. And they all work and they're good. Right. And so sometimes our processes, we know that the temperature is going to vary because of the heating elements of it. So I put a PID controller on it to keep the temperature within a particular range, right? Or if I can't control it that way, then I make other measurements to feed back into the process to keep it in a range that's important. But the trigger really is that when you're looking like at a process FMEA, for example, what are my high priority sources of variability that I need to either understand, I need to know how big that variability is and what's its impact, or I need to manage it and improve it. I'm looking for improvement ideas. So I think those are two triggers, is I need to understand it and characterize it or measure it. And process control set of tools is a great way to do that. Another one is it stable and can I improve it? And then the classic control charts, that's its primary purpose.
Excellent.
So there's my two. I'll stay with the theme of two ideas per
two
triggers.
Well, okay. And I agree with what you're saying. And let me just add an example. Because I have a point that I'll add to the conversation. So let's say you're assembling a bicycle wheel. Mm-hmm. You might get from some bins the spokes, you might get them placed somewhere. You might get the hub, get it set up, and then put the spokes in the hub. And then you might, in other words, there's maybe six or eight steps mm-hmm. that you do, and you wouldn't necessarily apply SBC to all the steps.
No.
But the tightening of the spokes, if that's an important metric, and now we get into what is important, significant characteristics. So let's say, for purposes of discussion, that the spoke tightness is a significant characteristic, then we might want to control or chart that tightness. So you're going along in the process, and then you can do a control chart on the tightness of the spokes if that's something that needs to be controlled. Mm-hmm. So there's everything, I agree with everything you said, and just add in the possibility of significant characteristics that are more important than other ones.
Yeah.
And that those might need to be controlled.
And, you know, that's kind of when you're going upstream from, well, because I need the feedback input from like a process FMEA or even the design reviews and design criterias. I often asked for and got, so what are the critical to quality characteristics here? Right.
Yes.
And if they say, oh, the torque on those spokes is critical in order to get wheel roundness, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I can measure roundness, but then if I know it's controlled dynamically by the torque, then I can measure the torque directly. And so we would create a control chart or focus on that part of the process and looking for ways to either improve its process or its consistency or both and things like that. But yeah, perfect.
Very good. So that's an example of the type of criteria that triggers a tool. And we're not trying to be exhaustive here, but we're just looking at different possible tools. We're not going to use all of them. I don't think we want to do the take the 785 list and do every tool. There's certain selection criteria that triggers tools. What about RCM?
Again, it's a part of a larger suite. There's predictive maintenance, preventative maintenance. There's a whole raft of different strategies. In the RCM, in general, just thinking through your maintenance strategy is when you want your equipment to be available, when you want it less downtime, more uptime on your plant and your equipment. It's kind of the trigger. You need to stop waiting for it to fail before you fix it, because that only applies to some types of failure mechanisms. Some types of failures that occur really don't give you any clue, and no amount of maintenance is going to prevent them.
So you have to have a little bit of knowledge ahead of time on what you anticipate as the probability distribution of failure. Is that what you're saying?
It's a piece of that. There's criticality and a bunch of other stuff that plays into it. But for example, if I have a motor and has some bearings and it requires lubrication, so the first order is that, well, instead of waiting for the lubrication to dry up and that bearing to seize and then go replace the bearing, well, how about I just lubricate this thing? And
at set certain it on intervals.
Set it up on a schedule. And so many runtime or certain calendar schedule or whatever. But another tool is, well, you know, that's an expensive process. I have to shut the line down to it. It takes restartup costs and so on. Well, how about if I do this more judiciously and let's use an acoustic system to listen, or a vibration system to listen to those bearings and lubricate it just when it needs it. Right. So I can minimize it. So it's a cascade of those kinds of tools, not just RCM, but all of these tools. Is the trigger is I want to improve my maintenance program to maximize or optimize my equipment uptime, right? At lowest cost. Usually it's between uptime, which is creating products or creating whatever the system is doing, versus, I'm going to use an example to try to explain, is oil changes on a car, right? I remember my first car was every 3,000 miles or 3 months, and don't you dare miss that. It was kind of, mm-hmm. my dad just beat it into me, like, figuratively. He said, no, that's what you do. That's what keeps it going. Oil ages just sitting there, and even if it's not used, if you're using it, it ages in a different way. Either way, you got to replace it. So there's a time factor and there's a usage factor. Okay, I got that. And tires are like that, right? There's tires mm-hmm. age by UV radiation and oxidation, and they also age by use. Especially the way my ex-wife used the brakes. They wore pretty quickly. But anyway, the idea is that if you understand the underlying failure mechanisms, like bearings and lubrication and so on, or alignment of your tools or whatever it is, then you can design a maintenance strategy that optimizes its performance but minimizes the cost of doing so. And so there's a whole class of tools that go after those strategies.
So the interesting aspect that you're guiding us here is that it isn't just a matter of do RCM or not do RCM. It's a matter of maintenance strategy, because RCM is one tool of a set of tools that could be used to improve the maintenance and operations of the equipment. There's also the subject of what's called maintenance significant items. Mm-hmm. So you may have a complex set of equipment in the plant, a complex system that does something, but only portions of it need maintenance analysis and maintenance strategy. And that's called maintenance significant items. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole discussion, and there's papers and literature about how you select which portions of the systems to use. And that comes down to what you're talking about, is you know, the bearings would take you in one direction, and the fan might take you in another direction. And so you can prioritize by significant items, as well as which tools are you going to use in the maintenance bucket.
That's right. And there's, getting back to the triggers though, there's also a whole slew of tools that are common in RCM type systems of making measurements, like measuring viscosity of oil or cleanliness of oil or metal particulate in oil, acoustic measurements, vibration measurements, thermal measurements, and so on. All those ways to trigger that we need to. What I guess I'm getting at is there's a whole raft of inspection tools, from visual inspections to performance monitoring and so on, including things like SPC. Is my process creating the fill of this bottle consistently? And if it's not, well, what in my process has changed that I go fix this thing? So it can trigger a maintenance activity, monitoring the performance of your product as you manufacture it. So they overlap quite a bit.
Yes, they do. We probably have time for one more. Let me try environmental stress screening.
Okay.
Just as a tool, and most everybody knows what it is, when would you use it? When would you not use it?
I don't like using burn-in, ESS, lot sampling at the end of the line. If your process is solid and you've done a good design of that process, you've minimized the variability in that process, and it's a consistent, stable process, you really should not have to inspect it at the end of the line. I have a pretty strong opinion on that. Now there are exceptions. ESS I've run into in types of tests like that. HASS, highly accelerated stress screening, is a variant of it. A vendor calls you usually on a Friday afternoon and says, oh, by the way, we sent you a lot of 1,000 units. We've discovered that 10% of them are bad. You can't inspect it. We don't know how to tell you which of the 10% is bad, but if you build it into your product, it's going to show itself. So it's like, the only way to find it is build it and then discover whether it's working or not. And I've had this happen a couple of times. And in that case, you start doing either 100% inspection if it's feasible, or you do sampling in order to identify that subset that are bad and get rid of them. I think
so. That's a remediation of some kind. In other words, you already know you have some deficiency in your manufacturing process, and then that's the workaround. But is there a time when you would use ESS that is not just a remedial? Is there any trigger?
Well, the trigger oftentimes is that you don't know how stable your process is. You don't know what it really is. So you just start your ramp and you start monitoring a bunch of stuff. And you look at those, you know, those critical to quality type parameters or the PFMEA and where's the highest source of variability. Well, in some cases, the best way to measure that, most economical way to measure it, is at the end of the line or at the end of the subsystems assembly, right? And so ESS type tools work great in order to gather that data. Are we on target or not? Now, it might be used temporarily just to identify, did we hit our target? Are we stable and consistent and we're making good products? Or it might be, we know we haven't caught everything. Let's use this screen to feed back into the process and then prove that we've made appropriate changes. What I have the prickly bit about with these kinds of tests is they get put in place and then they run forever. Nobody turns them off. Yeah, you got to take them out.
So there's a time frame with the uncertainty of your manufacturing process, or you're early on, or you have a very critical part that you must not fail.
Right.
And then you're going to spend the extra money to do some type of ESS or highly accelerated stress screening or that type of thing to see where you are. Mm-hmm. But then you would do that temporarily until you get your processes under control, and then start phasing it out at some point. And all of that, it should be part of your timing.
Yeah, and I think it's my old manufacturing hat. It's way more expensive to put all of that energy and materials and talent into building a product and then figure out whether it's good or not. Whenever highly encouraged is move that criteria or that decision point as early in the process as you can, including your suppliers. If you know you've got some aspect of a material that is 2-3 steps above your supply chain, you might have to go there to make sure it's under control, because if it's expensive when it's wrong for you, it's worth the investment to get it right as early in the process as you possibly can.
Sure. Yeah. Now, you mentioned one of your favorite tools, SPC. Let me mention one of my favorite mm-hmm. tools, and then we can talk about the trigger for it, is process control plan, mm-hmm. Which is a little higher level than statistical process control. This is the one that says, here's your operations, particularly your most significant operations. And then here's what they are. Here's the significant characteristics from the product that has to be achieved. Mm-hmm. And then the significant characteristics from the process that's going to make that dial work. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then here's how we're going to control that operation. In other words, here's the methods that are either
measuring or monitoring.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yep. And then here's what we do if there's a problem. Here's the reaction to it. In other words, there's a step. Some companies have defined templates. There's APQP, Advanced Product Quality Planning, has its own definition of control plans, or it could be just a general concept like we're talking about. And there's oftentimes in a manufacturing process or in manufacturing stations or plant, I'll want to use a control plan to define, track the controls, and that can drive them certain methods like SPC or other types of methods to be able to achieve the characteristics, the significant characteristics that you want to achieve for given operations.
You know, one of the best examples of that control plan I've ever seen, because it's very, very difficult to anticipate everything you need to monitor and control. And you certainly can't do everything. But this one factory had anybody in the plant, anybody could hit stop the line, right? I don't see that in very many plants. Other than the safety shutoffs, if there's a clear safety problem or an issue, you'd shut it off. Nobody would argue with that. But when it shuts down the entire production because you saw something that's creating bad products, that one you rarely see. So this control plan in the overall plant and its culture went to the extent of saying, you know, if you notice something wrong, say something, push the button, let's go talk about it. And it made it safe to say, hey, that doesn't look right. We don't just turn a blind eye at the end of quarter and keep shipping, right? No,
it's quite a culture.
Right. And I think control plans can scale to that point where it's beyond just, oh, we're monitoring this, and if it goes past a red line, do something. No. If it's just showing an anomaly, if it's showing something that that person's opinion is, hey, that's going to affect the final product, or that's not right, you can talk about it.
And the point of just to involve our listeners a little bit here, the point of Fred and I talking about this is not to explain all the different tools in manufacturing engineering, particularly manufacturing reliability, because that would take more than one podcast. The point is, for each tool, there's certain selection criteria. So you don't automatically use each tool in your manufacturing environment. You have to select which tools to be part of your reliability plan on the manufacturing side. And that selection has certain criteria. And that's the point.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of what we're doing is really triggered by, are we trying to make a consistent product or system as intent? You know, what's our target? What's our intention, our design? And the other part, the RCM touches more on, is our equipment efficient and effective at what it's doing? And is it available when we need to make products? And is it cost minimized for keeping it in that state? And so there's just a handful of criteria here. But it often relates, like we talked about in the last one, Carl, is that, well, we need good equipment designs. We need good product designs. We need to understand those relationships between what's that critical aspect in the design that we need to monitor and measure here and make sure our equipment doesn't alter it and so on. So all of these things interrelate and so on, but it all comes back to, when we select a tool, is, well, what question are we trying to answer? What decision do we need to make? What uncertainty are we trying to reveal? It's think through, what is it you're trying to accomplish, and understand or characterize or decide. And oftentimes that's good enough to help you pick the right set of tools.
Excellent summary. As a listener, if you have questions or you want to add something to the conversation, see if I got this right, Fred, okay, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR and fill out the form, and we will address the questions, and that can be part of a future podcast.
Yeah. And the other advantage of that is that we often get you an answer back directly by email, right? We'll try to respond to you right away, because sometimes it takes us a couple of weeks or even a month or so before an episode goes from the idea to getting scheduled and broadcast. So if you need a quick answer, oftentimes those are the things that we can do right away, and it sparks a really cool conversation as we expand it in our discussions. But yeah, please feel free to join the conversation, and we look forward to that. So Carl, I think these last two episodes have been just the whirlwind.
It's just indeed that we just touched on some very large subjects, and there's so much more that we could explore on these.
Yeah, maybe we should write a book on that.
Maybe.
it's more than we're finding it difficult, because I think this chapter on tool selection, when and why you use the range of tools. One is, there's so many different things to consider, but two is that each one's so flexible, and each tool is so flexible and can be used.
It's such an important aspect of a reliability plan is to, you get the gap analysis done, then you got to prioritize the gaps, but then you have to select the right tools. Mm-hmm. And so as a reliability engineer, you need to know what the selection criteria is for the different tools, so you can then author a lean and effective reliability plan.
Yep. Hopefully we'll get that sorted out and into the book. So with that, Carl, I think we should get back to writing. At least I should.
Very good. All right, Fred.
All right. Talk to you later, Carl.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.